Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says the country stands with power against the West's excessive demands and negotiations held to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Iraqi lawmakers from the Sadr bloc resign en masse in a bid to end the months-long political impasse and pave the way for establishment of a new government. And South Korea says the North fired a series of suspected artillery shots over the weekend as tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Iran says it has utilized all available tools and resources to stand up to excessive demands of other signatories to the 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the other sides should know that the Islamic Republic attaches great importance to the interest and welfare of the Iranian nation. He stressed that Iran's demands and expectations should be taken into account during the course of efforts to bring the signatories back to the JCPOA. The top diplomat underlined that Iran had put forward its initiatives, within a logical framework and acted accordingly. He said Iran seeks to secure its rights in the international arena while drawing attention to its red lines. Iranian lawmakers have voiced support for a recent decision by the government to ramp down cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog in reaction to an anti-Iran resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. 260 parliamentarians said in a statement, the agency's credibility has been lost. They condemned the, quote, politically motivated anti-Tehran resolution. They also cited a recent trip by the IAEA chief to Israel, whose nuclear activities are not monitored by the agency. The lawmakers said Iran has been the subject of the most intensive IAEA monitoring program, but this has not led to settlement of disputes over Tehran's nuclear activities. The statement said the agency's questions on Iran's nuclear activities rely on reports by the Israeli intelligence, and this shows the agency's demands are political. The resolution passed on Wednesday accuses Tehran of inadequate cooperation with the IAEA. Following the approval of the resolution, Iran took some retaliatory measures, including by installing advanced centrifuges and shutting down some of the agency's surveillance cameras. Iraq's parliamentary speaker says lawmakers from influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr bloc have resigned, potentially ending months of political crisis in the country. Mohammed al-Habusi made the announcement on his Twitter post after receiving resignation letters from the 73 lawmakers. Muqtada al-Sadr had called on the lawmakers to step down in a move to break the parliamentary stalemate and let a new government be formed sooner. The Iraqi parliament has been in turmoil since the October general election. Negotiations among political factions have failed to command a two-third majority in support of a new prime minister. Sadr's bloc had won 73 seats in the elections. A number of high-ranking officials from the UN Refugee Agency, including its deputy high commissioner, have visited the Afghan capital to discuss and support the needs of Afghanistan's vulnerable people. Rahmatullah Bahwan reports from Kabul.
As people in Afghanistan are facing acute hunger, poverty, and deprivation, Kali Clements, the Deputy High Commissioner for UN Refugee Agency, and her delegation visited Kabul to address the humanitarian situation.
This is a very important moment for this country and the people of Afghanistan. It is a time where the world's attention has turned to other situations of displacement, other war, other conflicts. But the needs of the Afghan people are incredibly important, and it's one of the reasons why I have come here now to this country to see how we can best support the needs of the Afghan people.
The UNHCR commissioner also stressed the need for providing a safe ground in Afghanistan for Afghan refugees who want to return to their country and for the people to enjoy their rights.
In addition to the 3.5 million internally displaced people, women, children, and men. There are 6 million Afghans outside of Afghanistan that want to see a country at peace, that want to see a country that is stable, that is inclusive, and that looks after the needs of its people.
Meanwhile, the Taliban's acting minister for refugees affairs welcomed the delegation and said that Afghanistan is ready to cooperate with the UN bodies and other charities to assist the Afghan people.
We appreciate the UNHCR's work and programs in Afghanistan. We expect the international community and the UN to separate the humanitarian issues from political ones and continue their life-saving assistance to our country. We are fully ready to cooperate with them in all of their projects across the country.
In Afghanistan, war has subsided, but the impacts of drought, sanctions, and cuts in global aid continue to drive people from their homelands to other provinces and countries. The UN officials' visit to Afghanistan comes as the country faces widespread hunger and displacement. Afghans are calling for solidarity and funding from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula as Seoul's military says the North fired a series of suspected artillery shots over the weekend. Seoul says the shots were of a, quote, traditional type with relatively low altitude and short range. South Korea reaffirmed its position of responding calmly and sternly to Pyongyang's provocations. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff also stressed that Seoul maintains a firm military readiness in collaboration with the United States. The latest development comes days after leader Kim Jong-un vowed to use power for power to defend the country's sovereignty. North Korea has carried out a blitz of sanctions-defying weapons tests this year. Those include firing an intercontinental ballistic missile at full range for the first time since 2017. South Korean truck drivers remain on strike for seventh day in a row to pile up pressure on authorities to hike their wages. The strike has battered the country's ports, including Busan, disrupting the shipments of components and finished products. That has posed major problems for South Korean giants such as Hyundai Motor, which had to cut production at some lines. In the southern city of Ulsan, hundreds of striking drivers have gathered at the main gate of Hyundai factory. Truckers have been protesting against soaring fuel prices while demanding minimum pay guarantees. The government has urged them to return to work, promising to reflect their demands in the legislative process. The strike has posed a serious challenge to the government as the country is grappling with a 24-year high inflation. 20 years ago, two 14-year-old South Korean girls were walking to their friend's birthday party when they were run over and killed by a U.S. military vehicle. Saturday, thousands rallied to mark their tragic deaths and called for a change in U.S.-South Korea relations. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi-sun and Hyo-soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate. Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A bipartisan group of U.S. senators has proposed steps to curb gun violence following devastating mass shootings in Texas and New York. The new framework notably has backing from at least 10 Republicans. That means it has a strong chance of earning the supermajority of 60 votes needed to advance in the 100-seat Senate. The reforms include stricter background checks for gun buyers under the age of 21 and increasing resources for states to keep weapons out of the hands of people deemed a risk. In the past, Republican lawmakers repeatedly blocked tougher measures against gun violence. They still insist that mental health issues are the root cause of the problem. The shootings in May have piled up pressure on politicians to take immediate action to stop bloodshed. Last month, an assailant at a Texas elementary school shot dead 19 young children and two teachers. Another gunman at a New York supermarket killed 10 black people. U.S. lawmakers are pushing for new legal proceedings against former President Donald Trump over the January 6, 2020 unrest that saw his supporters storm Congress. A select committee investigating the incident says it has gathered enough evidence that warrants criminal indictment of Trump for trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Congressional hearings are also scheduled that the investigators say shed light on Trump's attempts to spread false claims that the vote was rigged. The panel began its work last week and is now calling on the Justice Department to indict Trump. This is unprecedented, as no U.S. president or ex-president has ever been indicted. Trump supporters attacked the Capitol building when Congress was certifying Biden's victory. The attack left several people dead. In France, exit polls show President Emmanuel Macron is in danger of failing to secure a parliamentary majority as people voted in the first round of election on Sunday. Macron's centrist alliance needs at least 289 seats in the National Assembly to maintain its majority. But opinion polls suggest a newly unified left-wing alliance has made a strong showing. The left-wing bloc, known as NUPES, was expected to win 150 seats before the vote. Macron needs to maintain the parliamentary majority in order to push through reforms during his second term. He will also be facing challenges in freely choosing prime minister if his party lacks the required seats. The French parliamentary election is a two-round process. Candidates who receive the most votes will advance to the second round, slated for June the 19th. Our Paris correspondent, Ramin Mazoheri, says France's legislative branch cannot implement reforms on its own as it has to be consistent with EU policies. Take a listen.
In this new pan-European project since 2009, I think everybody will recall that legislative elections really don't matter as much as they used to. If we remember Syriza in Greece, if we look at Ireland, if we look at Podemos, if we look at, you know, here in France, legislative elections are less and less important. So we really have to be honest about where the pan-European project is after the 2009 Lisbon Treaty, which really made the European Union official. And the reality is that legislative, the entire national legislative branch is not as important as it used to be. Brussels is routinely telling the executive branch in Greece, in Ireland, in France, that these reforms have to go through and it doesn't matter how people vote. So that's really, you know, something that is, it's of vital importance, but it's not something that the mainstream media is going to talk about, because it shows the very undemocratic nature of the pan-European project. So we have to be honest about, you know, what the European Union really is, and it's run by Brussels, and they have given the executive branch much more power than the legislative branch. So that's the reality here.
Local elections have been held in about 1,000 municipalities across Italy. A low turnout has been recorded in most places amid growing disaffection with politics and anti-government sentiment. Here's more.
On Sunday, some 9 million Italians were called to elect mayors and councillors in 971 towns and cities in a vote in which the strength of mainstream political parties has been put to the test before national elections next year. Elections were held in big cities such as Genoa, Verona and Palermo, and in hundreds of provincial capitals. The turnout was lower than 50% in most municipalities, as disaffection with political actors and institutions continues to be on the rise.
On Sunday, Italians were also called to vote on 5 referenda regarding justice issues. The referenda failed because they did not achieve the required quorum of 50% of voters, a further sign of electors' disenchantment with the country's politics.
The doors of the halls of power have been closed and the people got left out. I cast my ballot today simply to preserve my right to vote. The government should have not held a referendum on such technical justice matters. It's been just a waste of public resources.
Far-right party Brothers of Italy is likely to win the highest number of votes according to polls. The Brothers of Italy was the only party that stayed out of Mario Draghi's government. Nevertheless, the ideological distance between its leader, Giorgia Meloni, and Prime Minister Draghi is narrow. Meloni, a staunch NATO advocate, is supportive of Italy sending arms to Ukraine and of increased spending on defense.
Polling stations have been deserted by voters, not only because of disaffection with politics, but also because the Italian media barely talked about this referenda and local elections. Their focus is the war in Ukraine only. We are sick and tired of politicians' empty promises.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and want the government to work for a peace proposal. Their calls have so far gone utterly unheard. Max Civili, Rome.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello! I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company! Power is out and the elevator doesn't work. I have to go up the stairs. Ah, the sound comes from beneath the stairs.
my God! A white, beautiful Persian cat along with its four baby cats are here. How cute they are! The mother cat might be hungry. Let me bring some food for her. By the way, today I'm going to take a tour to Dharabad Nature and Wildlife Museum. Stay with me. Dharabad Nature and Wildlife Museum is a complete center for introducing Iran's wildlife and natural species. This educational and professional museum is located in Tehran. The museum has a building which is 2,500 square meters, also covering an area of 12,000 square meters. In this museum, you can gain comprehensive and evidentiary information about the nature of Iran. This museum also provides the visitors with the sciences of taxidermy of animals, as well as keeping plants. The museum became a member of the International Council of Museums, ICOM, in 1997. It is also an active member of the IUCN-CEC, Commission on Education and Communication of the Museum. This museum consists of a number of sections. In Dharabad Museum, five orders of mammals in 13 families of different animals, plus 165 species of birds out of a total of about 517 species of birds identified in Iran are displayed in the museum halls. One of the remarkable and rare examples that have been added to the museum collection is the extinct Persian tiger skin. I am now at the end of Ajudaniya Street near Dharabad neighborhood. Not a long way to the museum. Well, this neighborhood has pleasant weather and walking in this area is enjoyable. I am now in the hall, which covers a number of species from Asia, Europe, and North America. Oh, what a big and strange hall! Oh, look! This is Python, the longest snake in the world. Thank God, it's a taxidermy. And here, there are Indian and Sri Lankan peacocks, male and female. The female peacock has colorful spreading feathers and it's gorgeous. And in this part, mammals from Europe and North America are displayed. This is moose. The biggest deer in the world. And this is the European yellow deer. Yes. And here we have a grizzly bear from North America. How big it is! Oh, the Siberian tiger. It's magnificent. And here I am in the whole of Africa. This hall displays mammals from Africa, as well as migrating birds of this continent. At the entrance of this hall, you can see horn and skull of wild African bull, as well as the ivory of African elephant. And on my right, a black rhino, wild dog, and African leopard are displayed. Dharabad Nature and Wildlife Museum has several diverse sections. The Hall of Northern Iran, the Hall of Central and Southern Iran, the Hall of Marines and Reptiles, the Hall of Insects, and many other spectacular sections. Well, art is long and life is short, as they say. Indeed, I can't describe all the sections of this museum in a brief radio program. I can just hope for you to visit this museum soon.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the U.S. is entangled in the Ukraine conflict, it is also pursuing another confrontational approach on the other side of the world, namely with China. At the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit, which ended in Singapore, China's defense minister hit back at the Pentagon chief Lloyd Austin, who accused Beijing of, quote, destabilizing military activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what steps Beijing would take when it says that it had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Mike Billington joins us from the Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, Virginia. Also joining us is Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mike Billington, I'll first start with you. When you have the U.S. defense minister meeting his counterpart from China face-to-face for the first time, he issues a warning pretty much. saying that Beijing must refrain from further destabilizing actions towards Taiwan, and that's a quote. Do you think that that's the right approach that the U.S. is using in this case in point in that summit which ended from the U.S. defense minister?
No, I think it's actually worse than that. I think it's good that they met, but what Austin did was totally in keeping with the incredibly belligerent, provocative moves by the U.S. towards Russia and towards China. I will add something to what you quoted from Austin, which I think is far more ominous. He said at one point, and I'll read this, he said that we will continue to fulfill our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act. That's normal. And that includes assisting Taiwan in maintaining a sufficient self-defense capability. That's also normal. That's part of the longstanding U.S. policy. But then he goes on and says, and it means maintaining our own capacity to resist any use of force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people of Taiwan. Now think of that. That is an open declaration refuting absolutely even the ambiguity policy of the U.S. and explicitly it confirms what President Biden said, which many people described as a gaffe, that we would militarily defend Taiwan in the case of a conflict, which means that if the Chinese government chooses by force or whatever reason that they have to consolidate their sovereignty over their province of Taiwan under the One China, Two Systems policy, that the U.S. would launch a global war. Does he mean that? Is this meant to be simply provocative to get China to back down? It's very difficult to say, but the problem we're facing is that the U.S. and the British and the NATO forces have repeatedly stated that they intend to win this fight to prevent Russia and China, and by the way, most of the rest of the world, which does not support the sanctions on Russia and does not support the demonization of China, but in fact continue to support Russia and China and have economic relations with them. But does it mean that they will either submit to the now obviously no longer true unipolar world?
Sure.
The myth that the U.S. continues to be the only force in the world and that the so-called rules-based order, which simply means the rules we make after having won the Cold War, as they like to put it, rather than the international law established by all nations after World War II. The UN and international law has been basically dismissed by this policy.
All right, Richard Becker, what are we to make of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China, when you have what our guest Mike Billington said there from Lloyd Austin, where he then comes out in the same forum saying another thing, such as reaffirming the importance of peace and stability across the strait, opposition to unilateral changes to the status quo, and calling on China to refrain from further destabilizing action towards Taiwan. To add and to question then, for what Mike Billington said, do you believe that the U.S., if China did make a move, would react and therefore start a war with China?
I think that we have to assume that that very well could happen. And we should remember that February, just this past February, the end of February, marked the 50th anniversary of the Shanghai Communique. And the Shanghai Communique was issued in the Nixon presidency, with Kissinger taking the lead in this, and between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China, saying that parties on both sides of the strait recognize that there is one China. What we see happening now means that that has been completely overturned by the United States. That declaration that there is one China. In fact, the United States is engaging in the most provocative behavior, pouring weaponry and trainers, and we don't know how many U.S. troops and trainers and advisors there are now in Taiwan, but we have to assume that it's a great many, that really, the U.S. is treating the neocons who are running the foreign policy in Washington are treating Taiwan not as if it's part of China. They never fully did. But now it's very blatant that they're treating Taiwan as an independent country. And more importantly, though, than that, in fact, is that they don't really care about what happens to people in Taiwan. They don't care what happens to people in the Philippines or Okinawa or Japan. They are all part of what the Pentagon calls the first island chain. That is, they view them as bases. And it was just a few months ago that the head of the Indo-PAC, as they now call it, military command for the U.S., said that the first island chain countries must be prepared for war, not just war, but to be able to come back. After they are first attacked, they have to have redundancy in their weaponry so that they can continue fighting against China in the event of a war, which I think that everyone believes is very welcoming. So, you know, I think that's an important point to make. The pretense in Washington that they care about the interests of any people has to be thrown out the window and replaced with reality, which is that this is a struggle to bring China down, to bring Russia and China down. And it's not my words. In 2017, the end of 2017, and ratified in early 2018, the latest national security strategy says that the war against terrorism has been replaced with major party, major power competition, or major power rivalry. And with the U.S. meaning that Russia and China are the targets and the context of the drive to make the U.S. the one and only superpower in the world. That's what the aim really is.
Well, let's hopefully clarify through you, Mike Billington, the deal that the U.S. has with these countries that it has military bases on. I know there's a status of forces agreement that it has with Japan. What is that exactly? From what I understand is that the U.S. can order the Japanese military, if it wants to take military action, for them to oblige, if that's a correct understanding of it. But what type of control does the U.S. have when it comes to these island nations or any country in that part of the world that they have bases in and their militaries?
Well, they have a serious problem in the Philippines from their view, because especially under the Duterte administration, but almost certainly also under the Marcos administration, that they will return to the kind of policy under Marcos's father, Ferdinand Marcos, who was one of the great nationalist leaders of Asia, who industrialized his country, built nuclear power plants, made the country self-sufficient in agriculture. And it was for that reason that they demonized him and ran a color revolution to have him deposed, after which the country deteriorated into being one of the most poorest and most oppressed countries in the region. So they're not sure they're going to have access to the military bases that they have, in a sense, still in the Philippines, within the Philippine bases. As to whether or not Japan will follow dictates, you might say, to join in such a war, Prime Minister Kishida gave the keynote at the Shangri-La Dialogue, where Austin was speaking, in which he echoed all of the U.S., NATO, British demonization of Russia, that he's fully joined in the attacks on Russia, and then said that that the China problem with Taiwan, that they're belligerent, they're aggressive, and that they're going to rebuild their military over the next 5 years. Now, I will add to that, though, a voice of caution. There is a upper house election in Japan early next month. There will not be another election for about 3 years. There are many, including friends of mine in Japan, former high-level officials, who believe that Kishida is making these kinds of statements in full support of the outrageous war policies coming out of the U.S. and Britain, more for domestic purposes, and that following the election, when there won't be another election for about 3 years, that he will modify this and return more to the kind of policy Abe had of being friendly with Russia and doing business with China and maintaining a certain balance. I will also add that there is there's a fight back taking place around the world against this U.S. British unipolar world mentality. Jai Shankar, the foreign minister of India, just last week said, Eurocentrism is dead. We will no longer follow dictates. And of course, that includes the U.S. from the West. Meeting of the South American, the Nations of the Americas meeting in Los Angeles, in which the U.S. refused to invite three members because they consider them, you know, authoritarian dictatorships, led to the complete collapse of that event. Not only did Mexico and the Triangle countries not attend, they just boycotted. Said, we're not going to tolerate your dictating who are members of the Latin American countries. But also Fernandez from Argentina, who did go, blasted this as an outrage. There are forces within the U.S., former high-level Army JAG officer, Colonel Richard Black, whose video warning that the U.S. mobilization for war against Russia, potentially nuclear war, with China obviously next in line,
right,
that this is madness, that this is creating a danger to humanity, and that this video has now 750,000 views. This is an interview I did with Colonel Black for the Schiller Institute. So there are reasons to be relatively optimistic if we fight hard now to inform, break through the information of war being waged by the Western media and the Western financial system, and bring these kinds of realities to the American people as well as the Europeans, that we can turn this situation away from the disaster it's heading for now. And partially that's because the hyperinflationary breakdown of the Western financial system is affecting everybody. Everybody now knows that the Western financial structure is in a state of total decay and collapse. Therefore, people have to think about what can we do to bring about a new paradigm of the sort that the Schiller Institute and Helga Zepp LaRouche have been fighting for with our conferences and our videos.
Well, Richard Becker, Mike Billington talked about the nuclear possibility between Russia and the States. There was a statement that came out of China that is pretty interesting. That was made by the defense minister to his counterpart. And he said something about to the point where there's been significant progress that China has made in developing new arms. And this is in regards to its nuclear arsenal. So that was in itself somewhat eye-opening. But then he made this statement. I wonder if you have seen China's 70th anniversary National Day military parade and the new weapons and equipment available to the Chinese military. In which he then went on to say, but we don't engage in an arms race. So is that a subtle hint as to what the U.S. would face if it wanted to go on a military adventure with China?
Well, first of all, let me say, I must take exception with your other guest characterization of the Marcos regime. It was really the U.S. Marcos regime that was overthrown by an uprising of the people. And the U.S., back in 1986, and the U.S. managed to transition it to another subservient regime. As far as what's going on in regard to to speak of the of China's military buildup, what does anyone think that China would do in the face of a massive U.S. military buildup? I mean, this is a vast buildup throughout Asia surrounding China, in Taiwan. Japan still has to point out, Japan still has at least 84 military U.S. military bases. Most of them are joint bases, or many of them are joint bases between the so-called Japan self-defense forces and the U.S. That 84 doesn't even include Okinawa, which is covered, or 20% or so of the land or more is U.S. military bases in Okinawa. And then there's Korea. I mean, there's a vast deployment of military, of U.S. military already in place and more coming, that the buildup is underway and it is continuing. So whenever we hear people say, and like the U.S. generals, they're alarmed by China developing new forms of weaponry. Really? I mean, that is so ludicrous when it comes out of the mouths of those who represent the biggest military contractor in the world by far, the biggest arms sales in the world, and the number one power in terms of developing new weapon systems, including modernizing, quote unquote, put the word in quotation marks, its nuclear arsenal. What's that for? I mean, that's promises nothing except death and destruction and possibly the annihilation of life on the planet. Sure. That's what we really see happening with the danger that we see coming from the U.S. aggression against Russia. And Defense Secretary, and again, I would put that in quotation marks, Lloyd Austin, said just a few weeks ago, the aim of the U.S. is not supporting or protecting the Ukrainian people, it's to weaken Russia. And the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian to do that.
Well, and since we're quickly running out of time, I have to ask your reaction, Mike Billington, on what the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said just last month. I mean, it really lays out the way that the U.S. feels about China, in which he says China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order, and that Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress. But I thought the impression that everybody had was that, and the U.S. included, was that China is technologically more advanced, like the 5G technology that it has. And yet Blinken's statement there is a diversion from that.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, what Blinken means by universal values are the values that allow the United States to wage regime change wars anywhere it wishes over and over and over again. I agree with most of what Richard has been saying. I will just say that if you want to get a sense of how one of the first color revolutions, the way that Marcos was overthrown, I encourage you to go to the Executive Intelligence Review website and read my material on how George Shultz and Paul Wolfowitz ran that so-called People's Power Revolt, which was a model then for their efforts to destroy countries all over the world through color revolutions. As to the blatant policy of Blinken following in line with the Obama policies, Obama-Biden policies for basically imposing regime change wars in places like Ukraine in 2014 and now openly running an effort to overthrow the regimes in Russia and China, that this is a policy which is only going to be reversed if we can bring the world together, including the U.S., to recognize that what is really threatening humanity right now is that the Western financial system is in a state of total collapse. We're holding a conference on the 18th and 19th, next weekend, on the theme that there will be no peace if the Western financial system is not put through bankruptcy reorganization. This is possible at this point. Because, as I said, everybody in the world is now aware of the devastating breakdown crisis, hyperinflationary breakdown crisis of that financial system, and that Russia and China have been working very closely together. Sergei Glazyev from Russia and Wang Wen from the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University in formulating a new financial policy for the world, not
exactly.
Just for themselves, not just trading in local currencies, but putting together an alternative which we can and must bring the United States through a popular mobilization to join with them. And our conference on the 18th and 19th,
well,
the Schiller Institute conference, will focus on that urgent necessity.
Sure. There is a lot of talk on this, Richard Becker, and we don't have that much time to talk about it, but there appears to be a very gigantic tectonic shift, if I may use that word, of a new world order, financially speaking, of which one of it is the fact that the U.S. dollar strength is going to decrease as we're seeing the forces move forward, such as the way that Russia and Iran, for example, are experiencing the way that they evade sanctions. And, of course, there's also the question of energy, where you have countries like Russia, Iran, and just the recent visit by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to Iran. You have these major oil powerhouses in one camp. Of course, you also can talk about China in that picture, where it all points to the U.S. Influence and power on the wane here. Are we looking at that to be the savior to prevent another war from happening? Because the war with China, I think, would be a totally different ballgame than the one that we're seeing with Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, I think that I just came back last night from Los Angeles from the People's Summit for Democracy, where well over 1,000 people from all over the hemisphere gathered as a counterpoint to the Organization of American States failed summit of the Americas. I mean, really a failure, a true humiliation for the United States, where the leaders of 20 countries, the heads of 20 states in the Americas did not show up in protest of the U.S. embargo, sanctions, blockade policy against Cuba, against Venezuela, and the exclusion of those two countries and the leadership of and the leaders of Nicaragua and, or any representation from Nicaragua. And so their summit was a failure. I mean, it was a complete failure, and the People's Summit was a true success. And I think it was a sign that the U.S. policy, that the U.S. power is slipping in different parts of the world. I think we have to also take into account, though, that when that happens, the imperialists may become more aggressive, more adventuristic, and I think that's something we have to be very concerned about. We have to build a people's movement on the ground in solidarity with each other across the Americas and across the world to call for an end to to U.S. aggression and belligerence and the threat of new wars, more even more destructive wars.
Okay, Mike Billington, final question along the same lines of what I asked Richard Becker. When you have so much energy focused on a number of countries that are not U.S. friendly, to say the least, I mean, let's just imagine if Russia actually takes over Ukraine by some sense and takes over their production of grain. You could see that then you have food in that picture also. Then is that something that would prevent the U.S. from its hegemonic aspirations or its expansionist policies, as we see?
Well, again, the only way to reverse is for people to recognize that the driving force behind the U.S.-British-NATO push for war against Russia and against China, not Ukraine, it's not Taiwan. Baker is right that they haven't for the people in Ukraine or the people in Taiwan. The purpose is that the Western financial system is breaking down, and they see that Russia and China have posed an alternative, and their reaction is
I'm sorry, I got to jump in, Mike Billington. We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Wish we had more time. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tagwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners from all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A on Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, if you have been following such shows, we are trying to answer some doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs with presence of Islamic scholars from Qom Seminary students. We have today invited Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary School, as an Islamic researcher, to answer the questions of ours in this very session. Sheikhana, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us, Sheikh, to have you here. And the question of the day is about our reaction as Muslim to some mob politics, or let's say al-mushrikeen. In case we refer to the Holy Quran in the chapter of At-Tawbah, verse 5, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَذَنْسَلَخَ الْأَشْهُرُ الْحُرُمْ فَاقْتُلُوا الْمُشْرِكِينَ حَيْثُ وَجَدْتُمُوهُمْ وَخُذُوهُمْ وَحْصُرُوهُمْ وَقْعُدُوا لَهُمْ كُلَّ مَرْصَدٍ فَإِنْ تَابُوا أَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ فَخَلُّوا سَبِيلَهُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. Dear Sheikh, you see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in his holy book, Al-Quran, very clearly and vividly tells us that in case you have found the mushrikeen and polytheist, kill them. What is the reason for this order that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala ask us to do? That is, whenever you see them, kill them, and that is, keep them and limit them. So what is the reason that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us to do so? Is it our duty to do the same whenever we see a non-Muslim, or let's say a mushrik, an infidel, a polytheist? Or no, it has been revealed for some certain cases. So I think it requires to look at the interpretation of the Holy Quran or commentaries of Quran, right?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, very valid question, and I can say the widespread question, and many people ask such a question. And, you know, unfortunately, we have some people, the ignorance of the verse of Noble Quran, and they do not have complete study of this beautiful sacred verse of Noble Quran. And because of that, it caused a lot of confusion among people. You see that...